Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hi, everybody. As some of you may know, over the past couple of years, I've done several webinars and video lectures on a variety of topics that also come up on this podcast. There is unfortunately a lack of qualified therapists who specialize in working with cult survivors and their concerned family members. And since I can only see a finite number of clients myself, I wanted to share insights from my 30 plus years of doing this work with as many people as possible. So, in pursuit of that goal, I've made all of my recent video lectures available on my website, rachelbernsteintherapy.com. You can find a link to the page in the show notes of this episode. There you'll find my lecture from the most recent conference of the International Cultic Studies Association, my, quote, Living in Freedom, unquote, series for survivors and their family members, and my recent lecture entitled Why Did I Stay?, which examines the many reasons that people have difficulty leaving high control groups. We plan on adding more video lectures in the near future, so if you have topics you'd like to hear me cover, please feel free to reach out to us and make suggestions. Today on the show, we have Jeff Gwynn. He is the author of the new book, Waco, David Koresh, The Branch Davidians, and A Legacy of Rage. He has written several other best-selling books, including The Life and Times of Charles Manson and War on the Border. Jeff was the co-executive producer alongside Leonardo DiCaprio on the TV docuseries Terror in the Jungle, which is based on his book, The Road to Jonestown. He currently resides in Fort Worth, Texas, where he is a member of the Texas Literary Hall of Fame and a two-time winner of the Texas Book Award. He and I had a great conversation, and he's also just a really, really good guy, and you'll learn a lot from him. Here's Jeff now. I am very happy to be speaking with Jeff Gwynn today. There is so much that we have to cover and so much that you have really done a deep dive into researching, which is really incredible. I am hoping that our conversation today will span a lot of different subjects, including government agencies and how they get involved in things and how they make things more incendiary, literally, at times. And I've talked a little bit about that on the podcast and dealt with that firsthand with police interfering with, you know, when I'm trying to help a family rescue their child. And they don't know what they're doing. And it's really very hard to be trying to help people. We're kind of working up against the cult leader, but then also the powers that be that are trying to quote unquote help. I'd love to be able to have you spend a few moments introducing yourself and then we'll start talking.
Sure. My name's Jeff Gwynn. I concentrate on writing nonfiction books about important moments or individuals in American history. Quite often these moments involve individuals who might be described as demagogues and those who have followed them. And too often, I think, in people writing history, the focus is only on what happened with not much emphasis on why it happened or how it happened. And these are the things I try to address in my books.
I love that. Yes, it seems I'm also a why person. There was a six-part series on Wondery, on a podcast on Wondery, about a particular cult group, also researching it, having clips of the leaders talking and talking to people who had left. And then after the end of the sixth, in the series of six, they brought me in to do an addendum, a seventh of the series of six, because what people were left with was that question, the why and also the how. How does this happen? And why does this happen? And yeah, it's interesting to see the footage and hear the people talking, but they seemed capable. They seemed bright. What happened here that went awry? And how are people susceptible? And why does this happen? And why do people get away with it as well? So many unanswered questions that also help not to demonize and re-victimize the victim. Because unless you see the science behind it, the social psychology, all of it, then you'll think there's something wrong with the person who succumbed to this. So it's a really nice way of kind of shifting the responsibility and the focus on where it belongs and people who are doing this to them, who seem to be unfortunately very skilled at this level of manipulation and fear-mongering. And so I'm wondering first, before we even start, what led you into your interest about studying demagogues?
It seemed to me in my study of history, and I've always loved history from the time I was a student. I remember back in 69, for instance, studying at the University of Texas, wanting to be a writer one of these days, and trying to figure out what the hell was going on with this Charlie Manson character and why so many different people were seeing him in different ways. That always got me. And the other thing that you bring up so very well, so much more eloquently than I can, I think, is that we have a catch-all word that gets used in so many situations, certainly the Manson family, People's Temple, and then, of course, Koresh and the Branch Davidians. And that four-letter word is cult. And quite often, members of the media, and almost always, members of agencies, police forces, federal groups, automatically assume that you've got some con artist leader who was duping real idiots that nobody with any intelligence, any capability could possibly be lured in. And so their reactions in print and often worse in law enforcement miss entirely ways that you could deal more peacefully, more calmly with people. It goes to out-and-out confrontation, and from there, it seems to only get worse because the full story's never told. You have dealt, I know, with so many people who have had to go through this experience, helping them understand a little bit, get more perspective on what happened. I'm trying to do that for readers. That's always the challenge.
Right. It is quite the challenge, and I think, you know, when you see how much people are not interested in learning about this, but still feel that it is their role to participate in helping a situation that's tense, dealing with these issues, but they don't understand the nuance, nor again do they have the interest in it, nor do they feel they have to learn anything new. It's like people applying something that might work in another situation to something very different. Like when I talk about doing exit counseling, sort of the non-forcible intervention, people imagine an intervention like in the show Intervention, where people have this model of everyone sitting around in a circle and people have brought something that they've prepared to read to the person. And so en masse, they're meeting with the person who really needs to get help going for treatment. If you sit a cult member down in a room full of people and everyone's talking to them, there is no way that's going to be successful. And there is so little that people, I think, feel they need to learn about why this is different, why this work is different, so that they can help, because they just assume it's the same if the language is the same. A cult is a cult, intervention is intervention, and it's really not at all. And so I love that you're bringing up this subject, just about that it requires a different kind of medicine, really.
It certainly requires different insight. In my career, I've noticed that often when I'm out on book tour and there's folks who've come to ask me about things, they all seem to assume that, okay, you wrote about Manson, you wrote about Jim Jones, you wrote about David Koresh. Well, that must mean that not just those three individuals, but the people who temporarily or even permanently chose to follow them are all the same, that every cult is exactly the same. If, for instance, you were part of People's Temple, then you must be one of the idiots like in the Manson family. If you are a Branch Davidian, then you're obviously some crazy cultist waiting to kill yourself at the Master's order, just like in Jonestown. And every group is different. People have different needs, they're hearing different things, and they're coming and staying for different reasons. Until you can understand that, there is no way you can objectively try to quantify this particular organization, this particular individual. I mean, we just try to throw people together and make it easier for outsiders to get it. And that means the outsiders miss it all.
Yes. I work with a lot of former Scientologists. And so when a lot of their more famous members talk about what an incredible experience it is for them to be in Scientology, that's true. They are treated like kings and queens. The other members are the ones who cater to them and clean their homes and also have to separate from their children and are used as slave labor and, you know, put in the brig, you know, in a ship somewhere. So yes, they are going to have a different feeling about the leaders because the leaders are treating them in a very different way. There's usually a hierarchy. Being able to see Manson also in different ways, where there's some people who he, for lack of a better psychological term, he gave the creeps to right away, and other people he scared right away. And for others, he was very attractive, even kind of sexy, and very appealing and safe. And what is that about? That is really, yes, that is a fascinating difference. So maybe let's get into that for a moment. What creates those differences?
Every successful demagogue is a great reader of character, is able to demonstrate, whether it's sincere or not, empathy. I get it. I understand you. We have a lot of things in common. The first step any demagogue takes, because there are a couple things they generally have in common. I'm not saying any two are exactly alike. Please don't think that. But there's a couple things right away that you notice. The first of the groups that I wrote about, and in writing them, that meant I spent 3 or 4 years, 24/7, studying it. You know, you talk, as you certainly have, not to just to a dozen people, but hundreds. And you begin to pick out things. But everybody, whether it's Manson, Jones, Koresh, has to always start out by making people feel, I not only understand what scares you, what makes you uncomfortable, but I am the one who can create a place, a group, a family, where that won't be true anymore. I am the one that can fix it, and I love you, and I've found you, and we're going to make it better. There's always, in some sense, that message. At least I believe so. You certainly have as much experience as I do. I wonder if that's been your experience.
Yes. So, yeah, and I just love to hear the way you put it. And yes. So what I have found is that sometimes people will ask me what kind of person gets involved in things like this. And I think it's a what question, but also a when question, that there's some people looking for things at certain times in their lives that they might not have been open to before or after that, but they were feeling fragile or they were away from home for the first time or they were just given a diagnosis that scared them. Something happened. And so, yes, I think sometimes people are going to be way more open. And in conversations with them, they will say to me, listen, if someone had approached me even a few months before, I would have said, leave me alone or go away. But now I was searching, or I was looking for a sign that someone cared. And then someone approached me and I knew that was my sign. I think what's also interesting is that, yes, these cult leaders, I want to say they wouldn't survive in the wild. Like, they don't have day jobs. Their talent is in reading people and using people. And so without that, without the connection to another person who they can manipulate and use and read, then they don't, I think, have any marketable skills beyond that. And they might know that about themselves to a certain degree. And that's why they're more dependent on their followers, I think, than the followers ultimately are on them, which they would never admit to. But I think that there is something really interesting about what people are looking for in these environments and what they also ignore. Because when we talk to people who got involved with someone who ended up really being destructive in their lives, they'll often say, you know, at first I didn't like this person. I didn't get a good feeling about them. And I was able to be talked out of that, that it was wrong of me to feel that way or was judgmental of me to feel that way, right? And
absolutely.
Yeah.
I've heard that so often, particularly from former members of People's Temple, as Jim Jones's excesses became more and more obvious. And I've heard this from a dozen people easily, that Jones would stand up and say or do something that seemed absolutely repugnant. And you start thinking, wait a minute, what's wrong here? And then you'd look at the other people sitting there with you, people who you've come to consider as family, people who you respect intellectually, spiritually, and they're still nodding and smiling. And the reaction then is not, wait a minute, I've been sold a bill of goods. It's, if all these other people who I respect accept this, then I must be the one who's wrong. I'll bet you've heard that many, many times.
Yeah, almost every time. So you're right. And a lot of the people who are nodding their heads are not in agreement, but they know, right, what will happen to them if they seem like they're not getting it or they're not open to it. And no one wants to be the only one. So most people are kind of faking it in the room.
They are. And yet, so you have all these people who may be uneasy, but they're not going to admit it because they think that would separate them from this group where they have come to try to find acceptance.
Right. There's such a multi-layered system of control here that, again, thinking about people trying to intervene, then they need to know this. They need to have talked to you and read your books to find out why this is different. What's also interesting when you were talking about allaying people's fears and that's what's the appeal for a lot of people and what keeps them there. Sometimes the fear is of something real and sometimes it's an implanted fear. Like, right, it's this idea, I sort of visualize it like this, that a cult leader will knock you down to the ground, like take away your life, your connections, make you feel scared, make you feel you can't trust yourself. And you don't realize or remember necessarily that they're the ones who have knocked you down, but then they'll come, they'll do that from like behind your back. Then they come around to the front and put their hand down to help you up. And that's what you see. And that's what you notice. And you appreciate them helping you off of the ground, not realizing they put you there. And you feel they're benevolent and you need them. And some cult leaders will even say, I sacrifice my life for you. I could be doing all these other things.
Absolutely.
Right.
I'm giving up so much that I could have.
Right.
Exactly. You know, when you say this, it brings to mind an exact example, if I could offer it.
Yeah, please.
Let's go back to Manson for a minute, if we can.
Yeah.
And I spent quite a bit of time in California at Corona Women's Prison with Patricia Krenwinkle, sitting, you know, on either side of a small desk, just talking about it. And Pat Krenwinkle, in her description of how initially she joined with Manson, perfectly represents just what you were saying. Manson was a mean, nasty little guy whose training was actually as one of the most screwed up pimps in American criminal history. He saw women simply as tools to be exploited. And he said specifically to people, you know, not in the group, but on record, that to make women behave, you wanted to find the ones who were bent but not quite broken. The ones that had terrible self-images, and first you push that button. Patricia Krenwinkel, all her life, had felt that she was disgustingly ugly, physically grotesque. She has a disease, has a long name, but basically means you have a lot of body hair sprouting in all different places. She had this terrible self-image. She comes to California to get away from all the people who were mean to her where she was growing up. And she has a sister who's divorced and has a child. She's living with the sister. And the sister is mean to her. And here comes Charlie Manson, first trying to find a few followers. And he sees Patricia Krenwinkel. And he has a gift, as these cult leaders, these demagogues do, of being able to zero in off almost instantly. The first thing he says to Patricia Krenwinkel, "We're both so ugly that nobody else will love us, but I will love you." And that gets her attention like nothing else possibly could. And so he asks her, "Come away with me. I'm traveling the country. We're going to do things." And to her, this is the opportunity, a man who understands her, who thinks, who says he loves her, it doesn't matter what he looks like. She gets in the beat up old van, and lo and behold, there's two other women there, both of whom have been recruited by Charlie in much the same way. They each join him thinking this is it, a one-on-one love affair. But they have to join, they have to stay in the group because Charlie knows the things to say to them. And it's an insult at the same time it's an embrace. Yes, you're ugly. Admit it, you are. But that's okay because I can get past that. I love that.
Wow. That's a fascinating conversation that you had. And it's really incredible that you had a chance to have these conversations. And it shows how sophisticated the recruitment is and also how simple it is, because you're just going right into someone's heart and you're helping them get what they didn't get before that they've always been needing. And so it doesn't have to be this complex sort of psychological game. It's just seeing what they have felt empty about and filling that space. Oh, it's so interesting. Wow. Wow. Okay. And does she talk about what it was like for her to have to share him with other people?
Yes, she did. That at first it was difficult. But then Charlie's explaining, "That's what I'm helping you with. The fact that you're jealous and uncomfortable. I'm teaching you how to deal with this because no one directly belongs to anybody. But already I can see you're growing. You're understanding these things, and it's so wonderful." Now, the fact that, you know, within months, if she didn't do exactly what he told her to do, he'd beat her up. A different analogy, I'm sorry, but if you don't mind my offering a slightly different one.
Please. Yeah, please.
Jim Carter, a former member of People's Temple, who in Guyana on that terrible day saw his wife and toddler son take poison and die in his arms, ready to die with them until Jones says, "I've got a job for you," and sends him out on an errand so that Carter is one of the few there that day that survive. All these years later, Tim Carter, a combat veteran from Vietnam, one of the most wonderful, kind-hearted people I have ever met in my life, who has become a lifelong friend, joined Jim Jones because Carter wanted to somehow make the world a better place, more racially equitable. Let's get away from gender discrimination. And Tim Carter, so many years later, now living in the Northwest, we're in his little apartment. He tells me he's going to tell me everything. I can judge all I want, but he's going to tell the truth. And starts sobbing, just breaking down, describing holding his wife and baby while they're dying. And he said to me, every day I wake up and ask myself how I could have believed, how I could have done these things. I think of all the times that I thought, this is bad. What's going on here? And then I looked at these other people whose opinions I treasured, and it was okay. And he said he finally decided that to be a follower of Jim Jones, or to be a follower of any demagogue, cult leader, he said, think of the frog in a pot of water. If you drop the frog in a boiling pot of water, it will leap right out. But if you drop the frog into a pot of lukewarm water and just gradually turn up the heat, it will wait until it's boiled alive. He said that to him is the way being part of a cult, a group like this. That's how it happens. You never find someone leading it who just immediately says, well, I'm going to make you do my will and I'm going to convince you that the government's out to do this or whatever. Bit by bit by bit. And you never quite realize until it's too hot to jump out anymore.
Right. Yes, it's too hot to jump out. And they've often taken away your world from you.
Which is another thing that so many of them say. After identifying themselves as the only one who really understands and can help you make the changes you need, the next thing they want to do is, as much as possible, cut off communication with outside voices who are going to disagree. And that takes a lot of form. It can be the obvious, well, don't trust the lying media. It can also be, we're your family now. The people you grew up with never understood you. They never really loved you. David Koresh had the best way of all that I've ever heard in terms of the Branch Davidian followers. He told them he was teaching them God's absolute truths that they had to accept if they were going to survive the end times and be some of the elect. However, they shouldn't talk to their family or outside friends about it. Because what God insisted on is once you heard the truth, if you didn't believe it, you were going to be the ones who basically were killed off in this new era that's coming. So if you went home, let's say, and told your parents or your siblings about it, and they said, oh, you know, that's crazy. How can you believe that? You were condemning them to death. And his followers believed that. What an awful and yet effective way of cutting off any outside voices who might disagree with him.
Right, who could poke holes in the logic, who could have a dissenting view, who could be your safety net, really.
Right. So there is no safety net.
There is no safety net. Right. It happens a lot that people are told to keep secrets. And they're not called as such because you're not supposed to keep secrets. But yes, something bad might happen to you if you tell it. Something bad is going to happen to the person you tell it to. I've had that also with being a therapist in the room with people who were told something bad was going to happen to the person they told it to, where I've had to, I've offered, because my clients were so concerned about my safety after I was encouraging them to feel safe enough to tell me what happened to them, that I would need to call them when I got home to let them know I got home safely. And the next morning that I had lived through the night and I was okay and not to worry and be so, I needed to reassure them that it was safe. I mean, that is why these cult leaders to a great degree get away with it for so long, because people don't know what's happening and people are worried about telling the secrets. Like people who I work with who are dealing with grifters, a lot of these sort of psychic healers and others who will have them embroiled in some scheme or scam. And we'll say the magic won't work if you tell people what's happening, right?
Yes, very much so.
Yeah, it's incredible.
And every once in a while, there actually is danger. When I was dealing with Manson, he's still in Corcoran State Prison, where, of course, he's never getting out. But Manson had followers all the way up to the time of his death, devoted followers. They kept up a website where Charlie could, you know, spew his sort of irrational meanderings. And Manson had good outside contacts. He found out I was working on a book and that I had found his sister and cousin and some other people who were talking to me. He was aware of that. You know, every day for several months, I sent him letters saying, I want to come talk to you. And it turned out he couldn't talk to me. He had lost visitor privileges for sharpening the handle of his toothbrush into a shiv and getting violent. But we sent a few letters back and forth. And Charlie basically made it clear to me, if I wrote this book, I was going to be sorry I had. And the book came out. And I found out from sudden emails and letters I was receiving from some very interesting people that Charlie had passed my email address and my home address on to some of his more fanatic followers. And it was quite interesting to see what they would describe was in my future. Now, as you have obviously found in your line of work, as I find in mine, the people who make just outright awful threats are usually the ones you don't have to worry about. They're just trying to scare you if they can. That there might be somebody who's decided, yeah, Charlie, you know, I need to get this guy. Charlie said so. And so at every book signing I had on that book tour, I admit I kind of nervously looked around the room and tried to see, is there anybody that kind of worries me a little bit? And again, for you, I'm sure that is something that you have to factor in. These people who have power over others are perfectly willing to sacrifice whoever they have to keep it. Whether it's the followers, whether it's someone who's maybe giving information that might make the followers question some things. It is a very, very potentially volatile situation.
Right, it is. And yes, I've dealt with harassment and or being followed, being threatened, mostly by Scientology. And that's why I also have an office space that has two different exits. And I mean, I planned it on purpose for myself and also for my clients who sometimes are followed. And at the same time, yes, there are a lot of hollow threats, but still, it's very difficult to deal with that at times. And it does dissuade people. I'm glad it didn't dissuade you. And I'm glad nothing happened to you. It can seem so intimidating, but it comes from such a juvenile place. You know, like they're just being bullies and they can't handle being called out for the thing they actually did, which is the thing that makes narcissists most angry, being called on the thing they actually did. Right, because you're right with what you share and you're honest and truthful and they don't want it revealed.
One of the other things that I've noticed too, I wonder if you have, this is wonderful to get the chance to talk to you because I'm learning as we talk.
Oh, great. Me too.
Quite often, these types of individuals hop up at moments of cultural upheaval. Manson appeared in the mid to late 1960s. And that was a time when America was literally being torn apart. Jim Jones and People's Temple start during the civil rights era in the 50s and work all the way up into the late 70s. But People's Temple really got a good grip out in California in the 70s, because that's when so many people had lost faith in the government, in so many things. And the church, mainstream churches, were sort of suspect at the time. So suddenly, in this era, the appeal of an independent group of socially conscious folks who were going to try to make the world a fairer, better place would work, where maybe in the 1940s it wouldn't have. And then you get Koresh, and the end of the world is coming. During the early 1990s, when we're having this beginning of the big schism in American culture, between sort of the conservatives who say we're going to have everything this way, no other way, supposedly the liberals saying, no, we want to give everything to people who don't want to earn it. And you get now biblically focused groups who, okay, we've got to get away from everything else. This is getting too complicated. Let's just look at the Bible, and if we can find someone who can teach us what's really there, that's the only thing that should count. Manson would not have worked in the 1950s. Manson would not have worked if he hadn't been out in San Francisco and Los Angeles in a turbulent time when young people were going there. Jim Jones, to grow his power, had to leave Indiana for California. There's more social upheaval. And the Branch Davidians are located in Waco, Texas, a place that's called the Buckle of the Bible Belt. And if you, for instance, were driving through Waco, stopped at a gas station for a fill-up, and an attendant came out, he's likely to ask you two questions. Do you want premium or regular? And what's the state of your faith?
Wow.
So these individuals find the time, the places that they can work their wonders or supposed wonders. Everything sort of has to align. Nothing happens in a vacuum.
Right. What I think is interesting, right, it goes back to this idea of the when question, you know, when people are going to be open to this, and why at that time, when there was the turn of the, you know, the century, the Y2K scares. There are a lot of cults springing up there during the time of AIDS, even COVID. There are all these sort of magical pseudoscience. I don't even like to use the word science as part of pseudoscience, because it's not even that. It's just pseudo nothing. But, you know, these cures for things that are making people anxious. I think it's so fundamentally rooted in anxiety. And I wish that the anxiety would be treated as such without needing to change everyone to allay your own fears about things. But I do think that there is something very important that shows us about our human nature and what we need during times of change, what we need during times of worry. There are some people who are who do much better with change than with others. And for some, you know, they can weather a storm and they go about their day, and they have a way of emotionally shifting and modulating internally so that things can happen around them. I mean, I think that happens sometimes because of your nature, or because if you've been through certain things, then you're going to have a reaction. Like in my office, I'm up high in a building, but it's a kind of a busy street near an intersection. And if you hear screeching brakes, I can tell sometimes if I'm working with someone who's been in a car accident, they will hear them and they'll react, when the person maybe sitting next to them who came in with them didn't hear it at all. We get sensitized to what has impacted us in a way, or in a traumatic way, or what we're worried about. And so then, because we're all living, we're coexisting with all these different levels of need, some of us are going to get very connected to the person who says, I have the answer and I will help you. And will also be open to someone deciding for them what they need, because it gives them a sense of having an answer when they didn't even know that was possible. And it gives them a sense of aligning with and communing with and connecting with other people when they've been feeling isolated. cults do very, very well, unfortunately, during times that are already difficult, which just makes everything more difficult. And the other thing I've noticed is that sometimes people won't question the answer they're given. They're just so happy to have it.
Absolutely right. Absolutely. And then, of course, there's the other factor that always seems to be forgotten. And that is how outside law enforcement look at these individuals and groups and how they choose to deal with them. You know, I've been doing what I do for about 40 years now, you know, but I have never been more shocked ever than I was when I first started interviewing members of the ATF and people with the FBI about what happened at Mount Carmel just outside Waco 31 years ago.
Yeah, I'm glad you're bringing this up. It's a great segue. I was just noticing the time and thinking, I think we need to get into this too. So let's get into Waco and the response to it and your conversations.
If ever I have written about any tragedy that didn't have to happen, it's Waco. And even though I believe that the ATF and the FBI did not want any fatalities, didn't want any casualties, that we came up to this line because it was the Branch Davidians who required death as part of the solution. They wanted to die at the hands of Babylon, as Revelation, they believe, taught them, so they could translate and come back, head up the army of Jesus, bring about the new age. But the FBI and ATF agents whom I talked to, and this wasn't just one or two of them, this was everybody from both agencies I talked to, they never ever bothered ATF as it planned for over 6 months its action against the Branch Davidians. The FBI, as it came in under international scrutiny, nobody ever stopped and said, what is it these people believe? Why are they reacting this way? They did not think it was important. They were only a bunch of religious assholes and idiots following some con man, and they had a bunch of guns, and so we got to do something. Well, there were things they could have done. And if they'd understood that the Branch Davidians were hoping they'd be attacked by Babylon, that to them was the sign that David Koresh was right, and this is what God wanted, and it was guaranteed from that moment there was going to be awful tragedy. Have we learned from that, for God's sake? No, I'd like to think we would learn, but have we?
I wish I could say we have, but no, I haven't seen it. I wonder what that comes from. Is that a sort of more militaristic bent, and that's it's like if all you have is a hammer, everything needs to be a nail? Like, this is the way we do things. Or is it hubris? What is it?
We look at these agencies. We look at a lot of police officers. They have to prepare themselves for the worst. And because of that, they must assume the worst. If anyone had just gone up and knocked on the door of Mount Carmel and said, David Koresh, can you come on out? We need to talk about this. That would have robbed Koresh of this conflict, this action that would, you know, just make him seem far more legitimate to his followers. It would have diffused the whole thing. And yet, we're talking about trained agents. ATF, they all came from police or served in the military. ATF had a great track record in that for the last 6 years before Waco, in all their operations, we're talking thousands of them, coming in after some of the worst gun runners and drug dealers and everything else, only twice was there ever any gunfire, ever. only 3 fatalities ever. Then this terrible thing happens. Why does it happen? The potential was always there. They lumped everybody together, every suspect. They're all the same, and that simply isn't true. And that meant that at some point, something like Waco was going to happen. And by God, it did. If we would just study now, all these years later, if law enforcement would study, not just what happened in Waco, but why did it happen? Where were the places that if we'd looked at it differently, somebody could have said, let's hold up here for a minute. We don't need 76 armed agents in battle gear jumping out of cattle trailers and charging the house. Let's just have somebody normal knock on the door and say, hey, you know, we got to talk about some stuff. That's why what you do is so valuable. That's why I hope my books help a little bit.
Yes, a lot.
How can we change basic aggressive assumption into, if not sympathy, at least some understanding, a different perspective, ways to work with rather than assuming you got to work against?
Right, right. I mean, I think it's so well said. So much of what we do in response to things is punitive. And, you know, I've talked about this with some kids who were sent off to some residential treatment centers that ended up abusing them there. Not all of them do, but some of them do. And, you know, their response afterwards was, no one sat down with me and said, what's the matter? Like, why might you be acting out? Why are you taking this? Why are you sneaking out of the house? They just got into punishing mode, which made me react. And then everything got worse because then, you know, fuel is put on a fire rather than water. And I think it is really important for there to be a much gentler touch and a curiosity. Like, let's meet each other. Let's discuss. And you're right. Any kind of gentle, reasonable response was going to prove David Koresh wrong. And when they're piping out all this music that is really an affront to their ears and most people's, I think, still, you know, it was just proving that the world is a scary place. So he just kept getting more and more right. And I think that happens a lot. I mean, you know, raids are a very tricky thing. And I've talked to people who have been a part of raids. They were the children on different compounds where there was a raid taking place. And there is a whole variety of reactions where it's hard to know still to this day if they're a good idea or not. They're a good idea if they're handled well, but there are some people who now are adults who say it was terrifying. They hadn't met people from the world outside and they're all coming in, you know, guns blazing and wearing uniforms and looking scary. And so they said, yeah, well, I'm never going to want to be a part of that world. I mean, it's horrible what's happening here, but it doesn't look as scary as what's happening over there. And then there were other times kids talked to me about having people come onto a compound where they were being abused, and then they left. Like they were able to be talked out of doing anything. And that also made them feel hopeless, that they were hoping to be rescued. And they saw the police or the ATF or whoever just leaving because the cult leader talked them out of it or was very good at manipulating the situation. And everyone seemed to be fine and happy. And so it's hard to know how to intervene in the right way for everyone there. But still, I think what you're saying is at its basic level, at least learn and find out about, again, why this situation is different and how in any way that you're going to be responding are, you know, to be able to evaluate if you're going to be making it better or worse. That just seems like at a minimum, but I guess things will get better once people are open to knowing that they have more to learn, which is a hard sell for some.
We have to keep trying to get that message across.
Mm-hmm.
Just as we're talking about this, we also have to acknowledge that the agents from ATF or the FBI in Waco were not terrible, kill-crazy people either. They were doing what they thought was necessary, what they thought was the right thing to do. they didn't understand the Branch Davidians, and the Branch Davidians certainly didn't understand them. We can communicate better. We can try to understand better. At the very least, that's going to stop some confrontations that are unnecessary. Won't stop them all. But even if we save one or two lives, isn't that worth the effort?
Absolutely right. And I think sometimes talking to the experts also includes talking to members or former members. And they're very often not included in the conversation. They were when I was involved, last time I was in Texas, I was helping train the social workers who were working with the women and the children who were taken off Warren Jeffs' compound. And they did include conversations with some of the sister wives and some of the lost boys who had been sent out to pasture, unfortunately. And I really valued that they were getting their input, because I remember before the siege at Waco, there were these two brothers, adults, who came in with their sons who had left the compound, and they couldn't get their wives to leave. Their wives had sort of been, I don't know, charmed by David Koresh to be special to him. And they were trying to reach law enforcement who were not taking their calls. And so they couldn't offer any of their own expertise. And it was so, of course, I can't even imagine what it was like for them to see the footage of everything happening in the news. And I don't know if what they would have said would have made a difference, but just nobody took their phone call.
Right.
Back to what you said about it being a conversation with a lot of different people, and again, being open to that. But sometimes people come in as, I'm the expert and I know.
Well, I think the work you're doing is so valuable. And I mean, the lives you've touched, you've done some pretty darned impressive things. Good for you.
Well, I want to hear about all the research that you've done. And I'm sure when you say it may have helped a few people, I'm sure it helped more than just a few. I'm curious about how you feel these situations are the same, even though, you know, they're generations apart. What it teaches us about what can happen and how it happens. And, you know, I think still it remains to be seen the best way to intervene. But from, you know, from Manson, Jim Jones, David Koresh, even Heaven's Gate, just so many of these groups, and what you've found it shows us about maybe even ourselves.
Above all, I think if we want there to be less of this, there always will be people who will feel lost and desperate and misunderstood. There will always be people who take advantage of that. That part of human nature is never going to change. What can change is making the effort to make more lonely people feel like you're not misunderstood. You're not alone out there. We need more agencies devoted to helping fix before someone is broken. Frankly, we just need more understanding. Law enforcement needs to change its attitude, at least towards getting expert and outside information. The fact you have to ask a couple civilians for advice doesn't mean you don't know what you're doing. It just means you're willing to take the things you do so well and still try to do better by learning from some others. There are a couple warning signs for danger, Will Robinson sort of things, that we all can be more aware of. People saying, I'm the only one who can fix this problem, that I'm the only one you should listen to. You can't talk to anybody else. I'm the only one who has to say, cut yourself off from your family and friends. We need to make it clearer as a society that these are red flags. We can't prevent it from happening sometimes, but we can do one hell of a lot better at letting it happen so often.
Right. And I'm wondering about other warning signs. So this is true, right? If someone says, I'm it, like I'm the only one. Yes. And you also don't want to see that on the other side with law enforcement. I know how to do this. I'm not going to be open, right? It's not different.
Anybody who's saying I am the absolute solution is not the absolute solution.
I love that. That's a t-shirt. And what else? What are some other warning signs that you've come across?
Male demagogues, and most demagogues, frankly, are male, at some point cannot resist taking sexual advantage of the women who follow them, quite often ignoring even such things as age. David Koresh was having sexual acts with 10-year-old girls and telling his followers, it's okay because the Bible says I can do it. If particularly you are a woman and someone, a man who has set himself up as the one who's going to change your life, ever takes a sexual gesture or step towards that, turn and get out now. Manson did it, Jim Jones did it, David Koresh did it, Warren Jeffs did it. It's almost inevitable. And another big thing, in different eras in America, different decades, I have never found one of them who didn't try to tell followers, completely mistrust the media. Because media, quite often, if family and friends have been cut off, would still be the only way someone might hear a differing opinion. Demagogues are going to definitely attack the press. It's always going to happen. It's guaranteed. Manson did it. Jones did it. Koresh did it. It's, again, another red flag. But the biggest one is I'm the only one that can solve this. That's the first one.
Right. And then if you believe that, then you're dependent on them.
That's right. The minute you give your belief in that instance, you're opening yourself up to everything else.
Huh. And then you feel, I guess, indebted, right? You're getting the answer.
Of course you're indebted. This person is taking all the things that weigh on me and easing the burden. Of course you're going to feel grateful. And they'll use that. How can you question me now? Do you remember what you were like when I met you 6 months ago? Look how far you've come. It's manipulation.
I'm curious about now. Like, here you have studied some of the most powerful, devastating stories and have found from behind the scenes what's going on. And in fact, yeah, the first episode that's now available, I think, to Patreon supporters, the first episode I did of this podcast purposely was interviewing Patricia Ryan, Leo J. Ryan's daughter, because I'd gotten to know her through doing anti-cult work. But I thought it is through Jonestown and what happened there that a lot of people heard about cults for the first time, really, on what can happen en masse. And so as an ode to that, the education people got and to her father's sacrifice, I wanted to have her on. You know, and she talked about not feeling so comfortable about where she saw things going. And I think it makes a lot of people very nervous. And because you have this background and this interest, I'm sure your spidey senses are tingling when you see things happening now. What are you concerned about? And what are you noticing? And what should people be watching out for now in present time?
We always accept the fact that religious figures can be demagogues, that use some form of faith or profession of faith to gain followers. I mean, Charlie Manson used some techniques from Scientology. Jim Jones, as a child in rural Indiana, would go to 5 different churches on Sunday, just trying to see what work that the different ministers were doing, and then pulled that all together into his own sort of act. David Koresh presented himself as a Seventh-day Adventist, saying that, and that's where he tried to get most of his followers, that all we're doing is we're taking this even closer to what God wants. And let's face it, I mean, there's an awful lot of religious figures. We see them every day on cable TV, saying, you know, send in $100 each and I'm going to be able to do this. And, you know, you're going to have good luck within 30 days. But what's happening more and more lately, and it scares the living hell out of me, is when religion now becomes an integral thread of politics. Because all politicians, in a sense, are demagogues. If you don't vote for me, the world is going to hell. But it was put more genteelly for a while. That's not happening anymore. And people have brought religious faith along with intolerance for the beliefs of others. And that's on both sides of the political spectrum. And I think we're coming to a crisis moment. And it's going to determine, at least for a little while, because all history is cyclical, things change and change again, where religious intolerance and political expediency are on a collision course, and it's going to be good, decent people who get crushed. That worries me. I hope it doesn't happen, and I hope I'm wrong.
Right. I hope so, too. Although we have started seeing a lot of it being propelled forward. And I wonder what we need to keep that tide from flowing in that direction, you know?
We always assume, as a culture, that people are going to apply a certain amount of common sense and restraint to their beliefs and in their insisting on their way with things. If you look at the constitutional issues that are always up in the air, the reason the Founding Fathers created the possibility of constitutional amendments is recognition that as we go along, we're going to see ways we need to change things. But again, now religion has taken its place right in the middle, and that you're being told if you're a good religious person, you're going to vote this way or that way. That's not common sense. That's not pragmatic anymore. Unless we're going to show common sense, as long as we're willing to be flexible enough to allow others their beliefs without saying it's automatically evil if you don't agree with me, it's just going to get worse. And of course, now we have all kinds of commentators on TV, on social media, any minute of the day. You can click on and you can find somebody telling you that everything you believe is right and everything everybody else admits is blasphemy. I mean, when, you know, at some point, I hope we're all going to say as a culture, oh, that's enough. Maybe we will. You know, I'm 73. I don't know if I'll be around to see it, but maybe you will.
Maybe. And maybe you will be too. I think that we are wrestling with that so often, where we're trying to figure out how to keep our country safe. And some people's view of how to keep it safe is to infuse God into it and a certain belief system. And for others, it's quite the opposite. Like they feel that that is a road to extremism and intolerance and superiority and keeping moving our country in kind of a religiously Stepford way.
That's a wonderful way of putting it.
Yeah, it's alarming. It's a scary thing.
It is alarming, but let's also remind ourselves that we've had eras like this in America in the past. We had all the Cold War craziness. In the 1960s, a lot of people believed America as a democracy was doomed one way or the other. We've survived Vietnam, 9/11 has passed, and here we still stand. It's looked bad before.
I like that. That's good perspective. It's good perspective, and it's also very different from how a cult leader would approach that, because they would capitalize on the fear around it as opposed to being reasonable, like, not so fast. We'll see, you know?
The other thing to remember, too, is yes, there are always going to be cult leaders, but they're going to be people like you who are doing the opposite work. And as long as there's that, yeah, there's always hope, right?
I hope so. And also people like you who are who are swinging open the doors, who are shining a light, who are saying, let's look at this and what happened and what maybe needed to happen that was different. What can we learn from this, which is very important. So let us know about your books, where people can find you if they want to find you, and anything else that you want to make sure to mention before we finish up.
The main thing I always want to mention is this. In my books, I don't give my opinions. That's not my job. The thing I try to do is find the absolute facts, documented facts, maybe some new facts that hadn't come to light before, and let readers make up their own minds. But I ask everybody who's in your audience, who likes to listen to you and learn from you, I've learned from you today, please, always think about whether something is rational or irrational, whether something has been quantified or is simply being puffed up as a threat that isn't. Be discerning, think things through. And when we do that, we tend to make the right decisions. So facts matter, history matters. Let's never forget that. That's the thing I would like to always say.
It's a beautiful thing. Beautiful thing. And so the names of your books, go for it, so people can find them.
There's a couple dozen of them. I've been doing this for a long time. But we've got Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson, The Road to Jonestown, Jim Jones and People's Temple, and most recently and coming out now in paperback, Waco, David Koresh, The Branch Davidians, and A Legacy of Rage.
Legacy of Rage. Incredible. Beautifully said. Thank you. Thank you. It was great to speak with you and learn from you. And I love the focus on facts, right? You're not there to persuade anyone. You're there to teach about what happened. I think that's the most respectful approach to information and to your audience. And so thank you for that. And it was really a treat.
I've looked forward to talking to you, and I was right to look forward to it. Thank you.
My pleasure.
One more thing before you go.
Thank you very much to Jeff Gwynn for the conversation today. I really do hope that I have a chance to speak with him again. There's so much more to talk about. Oh my goodness. The fact that he was able to interview people really on the inside, get eyewitness accounts, talk to people who were involved in some of these cultic groups, who were involved in fighting some of these cultic groups, and being able to see what went wrong inside and outside, how people really still to this day need to learn better about how to address when they are very concerned about something happening on a compound, and that the way to respond is so different. I really hope that ego does not get in the way next time of people really listening to the experts and listening to former members and people who just escaped off a compound who have the most updated information. There are a lot of people who come in and with this sort of, you know, being full of themselves, wanting to do good, feeling that they have the answer and that they know how. But I remember one time being asked to speak to police officers and speaking to probation officers. And these were in different places in California. They wanted me to come in and talk about cults and how to approach these situations differently. I've talked on the show about being there during a rescue where the police actually got in the way and let the abuser take a family's child away with them right in front of the family and in front of me because they just didn't understand what was happening. And they didn't understand that the family had been trying to rescue this child for years and years. They didn't even listen to the family. And they didn't listen to me. But they thought they were doing something to protect this person. And the only question they asked on scene was, is this person over 18 who is basically being dragged away by this person controlling them? And then they were put in a car and they drove away. And the police thought they had done something good. They were kind of standing there with smiles on their faces as though they had protected this person, having no idea what they had done. And in fact, in this particular situation, when I spoke to the person who was the child of this family years later, she said to me, "When I saw the police show up, I thought, finally, I'm going to be rescued. And then when I saw them protect the person who was dragging me away, because they thought they were protecting me, and all they asked me was if I was over 18, they didn't ask me, are you here of your own free will? They didn't ask me if I was frightened. They didn't ask me if I was drugged, if I was injured, because all of those things were true. But the police had no training. And this woman felt so despondent and so desperate and hopeless after she saw the police protect her perpetrator. It is so important that people learn how to do this better. It is also really important to be able to understand how it can happen at all that somebody like a Charles Manson or someone who might seem charismatic to some is able to gain a foothold over people, to be able to really get under their skin, to really get into their heads. When Jeff talked about how he's sort of fascinated by the fact that there are these people like Charlie Manson who are going to be seen in very different ways by different people, that's always going to be the case, that some people are going to be charmed while other people are going to be repelled by the same person. What I have noticed very often is that people have sometimes said to me after they've been rescued from a cult or from a highly controlling relationship, they were put off by the person at first. They would go to the other side of the street when they saw them coming. They didn't want to be touched by them. They didn't believe them right away that they really cared and that they really could help them in some way or that they really loved them. They actually felt, some people say, scared by them. Some people would say creeped out. But they slowly learned instead to kind of fall in love with them because they started to believe that they could love them like no one else. And they started to believe the message on the part of the controller that no one else loved them in the same way and that there was no chance for them ever to be loved in that same way. And their family somehow is now seen as some group of people who rejected them and will always reject them. People sometimes will really connect with the person who they think is their only hope to be rescued, their only hope to be loved. And then what you have there, especially if at first that person made them scared or made them creeped out, is you start to have Stockholm syndrome. You basically start to feel connected to and protective of and in love with your kidnapper, whether it's a physical kidnapper, emotional kidnapper. In either situation, Stockholm syndrome can apply. I also think it was really interesting because this has been a recurring theme on the podcast quite a bit, as you've probably noticed, that one of the things that scares Jeff really the most now, as he said, is that religion has gotten more involved in politics, which is causing more religious intolerance, which is also going to cause more of these groups like the Branch Davidians to be able to get a foothold, to be able to also be protected by the government. There are so many churches that have over the years become abusive, but then when people will say something bad happened to me there, or they take them to court, or they say something in the news about them, kind of letting people know this is a dangerous place, they then cry religious persecution. And sometimes that makes people back off because in our country, we don't want to be accused of being intolerant, of persecuting a religion. The problem is that I think when something might start as a religion, but then crosses so many boundaries and hurts people time and time again and feels entitled to keep hurting them, it should no longer qualify as a religion. It should no longer be able to get tax-exempt status. It should no longer be able to cry religious persecution. If people are trying to get justice for the hurt that that group has caused, and it should no longer be able to be protected by our government, especially if it is more protected than its victims. Thank you so much to Jeff for all of the work that he's done over the years, and I look forward to hopefully talking to him again soon. Take good care. Talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.